Chapter 2. New Ways of Seeing the World. Resisting Grand Narratives. A great deal of postmodernist theory depends on the maintenance of a skeptical attitude, and here the philosopher Jean-François Lyotard's contribution is essential. He argued in his La Condition Postmoderne, published in French in 1979, in English in 1984, that we now live in an era in which legitimizing master narratives are in crisis and in decline. These narratives are contained in or implied by major philosophies, such as Kantianism, Hegelianism, and Marxism, which argue that history is progressive, that knowledge can liberate us, and that all knowledge has a secret unity. The two main narratives Lyotard is attacking are those of the progressive emancipation of humanity, from Christian redemption to Marxist utopia, and that of the triumph of science. Lyotard considers that such doctrines have lost their credibility since the Second World War, writing, "Simplifying to the extreme, I defined postmodern as incredulity towards meta-narratives." These meta-narratives traditionally serve to give cultural practices some form of legitimation or authority. The legitimation of Marxist or Freudian theories thus would stem from their claim, not widely accepted by now, that they are based on the principles or meta-narrative of science. Another example of this would be the textbook history of the writing of the Constitution of the United States by the Founding Fathers, along with its subsequent legislative enactments. This grand historical narrative with its constitutional founding principles is still very much a going concern in current disputes in the United States about the limits of free speech, the right to abortion, and the right of American private citizens to bear arms. Another simple example of meta-narrative is the Marxist belief in the predestined and privileged function of the proletariat, with the party as its ally, in bringing about a revolution and in the utopia which is supposed to follow when the state has withered away. In the period since 1945, the governments of many formerly colonized territories have developed similarly would-be masterful political narratives about the history of nationalist struggle. It is difficult to avoid such narratives, and nearly all nation-states have them. Although there are good liberal reasons for being against such grand narratives, on the grounds that they do not allow for disputes about value and often enough lead to totalitarian persecution, the plausibility of Lyotard's claim for the decline of meta-narratives in the late 20th century ultimately depends upon an appeal to the cultural condition of an intellectual minority. The general sociological claim that such narratives are in decline in our period looks pretty thin, even after the collapse of state-sponsored Marxism in the West, because allegiances to large-scale, totalizing religious and nationalistic beliefs are currently responsible for so much repression, violence, and war in Northern Ireland, Serbia, the Middle East, and elsewhere. Postmodernists tend not to be well informed about current practices in science and religion. It is obvious to any reader of the newspapers that men and women are still more or less willing to kill one another in the name of grand narratives every day. Think of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. Indeed, the reason why academic postmodernists seemed so secure in their hostile analysis of the American and European societies around them in the 1970s may well have derived from the fact that these societies were not torn apart by contrary ideologies. Some thoughts about the rival claims of Islam and Judaism in the Middle East, or of Marxism and the democratic process in Eastern Europe, might have led to different conclusions. But the skepticism about commitments to master narratives promoted by Lyotard and echoed by Derrida and many other postmodernists had a strong appeal to a generation brought up in Western democracies. They were liberated to some degree from theology by existentialism, impressed by the resistance offered to capitalism and the military-industrial complex in 1968, suspicious of American imperialist pretensions, and perhaps more importantly, needed to escape the deadeningly Manichaean ideological platitudes of the Cold War period. The result was that the basic attitude of postmodernists was a skepticism about the claims of any kind of overall totalizing explanation. Lyotard was not alone in seeing the intellectual's task as one of resistance, even to consensus, which has become an outmoded and suspect value. Postmodernists responded to this view partly for the good reason that by doing so, they could side with those who didn't fit into the larger stories, the subordinated and the marginalized, against those with the power to disseminate the master narratives. Many postmodernist intellectuals thus saw themselves as avant-garde and bravely dissentient. This heralded a pluralist age, in which, as we shall see, even the arguments of scientists and historians are to be seen as no more than quasi-narratives which compete with all the others for acceptance. They have no unique or reliable fit to the world, no certain correspondence with reality. They are just another form of fiction. Of course, in opposition to such narratives, particularly holistic or totalitarian ones, is an absolutely traditional liberal concern. Much significant postmodernist writing has therefore turned on articulating this kind of skepticism for essentially liberal ends, as, for example, in the work of Edward Said, who in his Orientalism from 1978 attempted to show the distorting effects of the projection of the Western grand narrative of imperialism upon Oriental societies. For the imperialist saw himself as the representative of a rational, ordered, peaceful, and law-abiding framework, and defined the Orient as the opposite of this, for example as the muddle Forster found in A Passage to India, and had the confidence that his representation of them, his narrative of Orientalism, would prevail. The grand imperial story of progressive development was superimposed on a merely local, and what is more, deviant, Oriental practice. In all this, Said follows Foucault and the euphemerism of the Greeks and of Nietzsche in believing that such imposing political grand narratives are at best mystificatory attempts to keep some social groups in power and others out of it. As Said notes, when Flaubert slept with an Egyptian courtesan, Kuchuk Hanem, he wrote to Louise Collet that the Oriental woman is no more than a machine. She makes no distinction between one man and another man. In so doing, and in his subsequent novels, he produced a widely influential model of the Oriental woman. But within this influential narrative, she never spoke of herself, never represented her emotions, presence, or history. We can imagine how different her own account might indeed have been, but the two frameworks for narrative, Flaubert's and Kuchuk Hanem's, seem to be culturally incommensurable. Hence, a typical postmodernist conclusion that universal truth is impossible and relativism is our fate. Deconstruction. The confidence with which such claims were made was influenced to a huge degree by a reading of the philosophy of Jacques Derrida, in whose voluminous writings the most elaborate version of this deconstructive attitude was to be found. The central argument for deconstruction depends on relativism, by which I mean the view that truth itself is always relative to the differing standpoints and predisposing intellectual frameworks of the judging subject. It is difficult to say, then, that deconstructors are committed to anything as definite as a philosophical thesis. Indeed, the attempt to define deconstruction is to defy another of its main principles, which is to deny that final or true definitions are possible, because even the most plausible candidates will always invite a further defining move or play with language. For the deconstructor, the relationship of language to reality is not given, or even reliable, since all language systems are inherently unreliable cultural constructs. Derrida and his followers nevertheless seem to be committed to one fairly clear historical proposition, that philosophy and literature in the Western tradition had for too long falsely supposed that the relationship between language and world was, on the contrary, well-founded and reliable, and even for some religions, guaranteed by God. This false, logocentric confidence in language as the mirror of nature is the illusion that the meaning of a word has its origin in the structure of reality itself, and hence makes the truth about that structure directly present to the mind. All this amounts to a false metaphysics of presence. This is Derrida's own grand meta-narrative, and he seems quite falsely to assume that there was nothing in the Western metaphysical philosophical tradition which put into question the fit of language to the world. But nominalism and essentialism have long been at odds. In fact, Wittgenstein had notoriously tried to work out an absolutely stable and reliable relationship of language to world in his Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus from 1922. and then had completely repudiated its position in favor of a theory of relativistically related language games by the time of the posthumous publication of his Philosophical Investigations in 1953. Nevertheless, as a disobliging characterization of a culture that had come increasingly to rely on such claims to a good fit in science and in the all-conquering capitalist technology which was supposed to flow from it and justify it, Derrida's skepticism had a considerable political appeal. It allowed his followers to attack those who believed that philosophy, science, or the novel really did describe the world accurately, or that a historical narrative can be true. Literary people in particular were accused by Derridians of a naive trust in what was ironically dubbed the classic realist text. Such persons simply fail to appreciate the nature of the language from which they derive their false confidence. In reading George Eliot's Middlemarch from 1882, for example, we may have the illusion, not actually shared by George Eliot, that she simply opens a window upon reality, and that her discourse is fully adequate to a description of the real. Our reliance upon Eliot's narrative voice and language puts us in a dominating, even godlike position, especially if we rely upon the generalizations that she makes. So we think we know the truth about Dorothea Brooke when all we really know is Eliot's descriptions of her. And in any case, what happens when we come across a metaphor? Are they true, too? To give an example, Dorothea, bewildered and distressed by her experience of Casaubon's unsatisfactoriness as a husband, thinks that her life seemed to have become a mask with enigmatical costumes. Quite apart from the problems of interpreting the metaphor, it will only work within a culture in which masks and their functions are understood in a certain way. The description of Dorothea is only valid within, and so relative to, the mask-appreciating discourse which is current within a certain group. The postmodernist deconstructor wishes then to show how a previously trusted relationship, like this one between language and the world, will go astray. Look, we say, it's just a systematically misleading metaphor about a mask. However, it is logically obvious that you can't demonstrate how language always goes astray without, at the same time, having a secret and contradictory trust in it. For without a pretty confident notion of the truth, how can we show that any particular stretch of language has gone astray or fallen into contradiction? This is a crippling mystery to those hostile to deconstruction, and a sustaining one to those who practice its faith. Why, then, should deconstructors wish to call into question our reliance on authors like Eliot, and with her, much of the previous philosophical tradition? Signs as systems. Derridians insisted that all words must be explained only in terms of their relationships to the various systems in which they take part. It follows that we are at best relativists, caught within incommensurable conceptual systems. We can only know what they permit us to know about reality. Whatever we say, we are caught within a linguistic system that does not relate to external reality in the way we expect, because every term within each system also alludes to or depends upon the existence, or as Derrida put it, the trace, of other terms within the system that are absent. For example, English has a family of words for degrees of anger, from irritated to furious, and French has its own different family for this area of our experience. All the terms within each language's family rely upon one another to divide up the field of anger for native speakers. But neither system, English or French, different as they clearly are, can fairly claim to finally encode the truth about states of anger in the world. Nor can Eliot claim to finally encode the truth about Dorothea's disillusionment. For Derridians, then, language only seems to mark out clear differences between concepts. It actually only defers or pushes away its partners within the system for a while. Our concepts thus mark, for Derridians, a différence, or a deferring of meaning, just as much as they signify a difference. The French neologism puns between the two. For meaning perpetually slips away from word to word within the linguistic chain. Derrida goes on from this venerable form of conceptual relativism to suggest ways in which all conceptual frameworks, once seen this way, can be criticized. This is his key contribution to the postmodernist attitude, and it doesn't much depend on the correctness or otherwise of his philosophical position, for he sees all conceptual systems as prone to a falsifying, distorting hierarchization. Not only is our knowledge of the world not as direct as we like to believe, metaphor-ridden and entirely relative to the scope of our conceptual systems, but we have been all too confident about the ways in which the central categories within those systems work to organize our experience. For example, George Eliot clearly relies in the passage to which I alluded on a clear distinction between appearance and reality, and between people being themselves and merely acting, as in a mask or wearing a disguise. We tend to privilege or rely upon what Derrida calls particular transcendental signifiers, such as God, reality, the idea of man, to organize our discourse. The conceptual oppositions we tend to employ to do this organization for us, speech versus writing, soul versus body, literal versus metaphorical, natural versus cultural, masculine versus feminine, make us get lots of fundamental relationships wrong, or at least too rigidly fixed. In particular, we tend to put one of these terms above the other, so that, for example, woman is thought of as inferior to man, Oriental inferior to Western. But within a more relativistic conceptual scheme, we can see that they really depend on one another for their definition. Indeed, it was a very Freudian obsession of Derridians that apparent opposites really need one another and always imply one another. I can only see myself as a rational, justice-seeking imperialist, like Forster's Ronnie Fielding, if you are at the same time to be seen as a wily, slippery, muddled Oriental, like Forster's Aziz. The innovatory, liberating aspect of this type of deconstruction of oppositions works in this way. When we look at particular systems like this, which purport to describe the world correctly, we can see that the concepts they privilege or make central, and the hierarchies they order them into, are not nearly so certainly in the right order, and are much more interdependent than we thought. For Derridians, indeed, the revelation of their hidden interdependence deconstructs them. They can be undone or reversed, often to paradoxical effect, so that truth is really a kind of fiction. Reading is always a form of misreading, and most fundamentally, understanding is always a form of misunderstanding, because it is never direct, is always a form of partial interpretation, and often uses metaphors when it thinks it is being literal. It is this central use of deconstruction to subvert our confidence in logical, ethical, and political commonplaces that has proved most revolutionary and typical of postmodernism. For the relativist claim is that once we see our conceptual systems in this way, we can also see that the world, its social systems, human identity even, are not givens, somehow guaranteed by a language which corresponds to reality, but are constructed by us in language, in ways that can never be justified by the claim that this is the way that such things really are. We live not inside reality, but inside our representations of it. In a notorious Derridian aside, there is nothing outside the text, only the more text that we use to try to describe or analyze that to which texts purport to refer. All this can give us the confidence to break away from an allegiance to any given systems and to believe that the way we see the world can and should be changed. Deconstructors, liberals, and Marxists can all get into some kind of alliance here in denying that any dominant ideology or post-Enlightenment, Kantian, universalizing, or imperialist language can really describe the way things are. Playing with the text. Deconstruction, particularly as practiced by literary critics, was culturally most influential when it refused to allow an intellectual activity or a literary text or its interpretation to be organized by any customary hierarchy of concepts, and particularly those exemplified above. In performing these tasks, deconstruction disrupted the text's organization and contested what it saw as merely arbitrary delimitations of its meanings. This was because the différence, or semi-concealed dependence of one concept on others in its family, is illimitable. We could travel right through the dictionary on the pathways opened up by one word. This notion of a dynamically interrelated, potentially unlimited language field helped to ally deconstructive theory to the experimental attitudes of many avant-gardist, postmodernist writers. The new novelists in France and a number of American experimental writers, such as Walter Abiche, Donald Barthelme, Robert Coover, and Ray Fetterman, were influenced by such ideas. The language and conventions of texts and pictures and music became something to play with. They were not committed to delimited arguments or narratives. They were the mere disseminators of meanings. Ray Fetterman wrote in Take It or Leave It, a novel from 1976, "I know what you guys are going to come up with next. And what about representation? Yes, what about it? Correct, strict representation of reality. Words sticking to things. Meaning sticking to words. Signifiant, signifier. Exact use of grammatology. Cuckoo. In order to differentiate speaking from writing and shouting from mumbling. Yes, I know what you think of writing, and that for you guys it's an important, crucial question. But we've already discussed all that, and me, in a sense, in la logique du sang, if you wish. I don't give a damn about the order of things, because me, I do not relate. I do not narrate. I do not recite in order to create order, rather not. On the contrary, what I do has to do with the problem of reading or listening. And not l'écriture. Me, I speak to the senses, and I'm not trying to make sense in any way. I deal in nonsense. I deal in surfiction. Or, if you prefer, I'm working my way toward unreadability, toward free reading, delirious reading. In a way, I'm in favor of reading in flagrant breach of peace, caught in the act. Flagrante delicto. Don't fuck around. But okay, I'll stop this crap. Single space, double space, triple space, and all that typographical masturbation. To tell the truth, it disgusts me just as much as it might disgust you. But sometimes it is necessary to talk or even write about such things, just to situate the problem correctly. Yes, but what happens to language, you might ask? What happens to meaning? Good question. The play of postmodernist fiction with theory is best when it is also comic. The death of the author. Most importantly, the reader, listener, spectator involved in the articulation or interpretation of this play of language should act independently of any supposed intentions of an author. Attention to an author would privilege quite the wrong thing. For seeing him or her as an origin or a delimiting authority for the meaning of the text was an obvious example of the logocentric privileging of a particular set of meanings. Why should these not originate in the reader just as much as the author? Authorial or historical intention should no more be trusted than realism. There thus arose a new notion of the text as a free play of signs within language. This proclamation of the death of the author, notably by Barthes and Foucault, also had the political advantage of doing away with him or her as the bourgeois capitalist owner and marketer of his or her meanings. As Roland Barthes put it in The Death of the Author in Image Music Text from 1977, "We know now that a text is not a line of words releasing a single theological meaning, the message of the author God, but a multidimensional space in which a variety of writings, none of them original, blend and clash. Literature, by refusing to assign a secret and ultimate meaning to the text and to the world as text, liberates what may be called an anti-theological activity, an activity that is truly revolutionary, since to refuse to fix meaning is in the end to refuse God and his hypostasis, reason, science, law." The text, as really constructed by the reader, was thereby liberated and democratized for the free play of the imagination. Meanings became the property of the interpreter, who was free to play deconstructively with them. It was thought to be both philosophically wrong and politically retrogressive to attempt to determine the meaning of a text, or any semiotic system, to particular ends. All texts were now liberated to swim, with their linguistic or literary or generic companions, in a sea of intertextuality, in which previously accepted distinctions between them hardly mattered, and to be seen collectively as forms of playful, disseminatory rhetoric, rather like Derrida's own lectures, which became freewheeling, disorganized, unfocused, lengthy monologues. The pursuit of verbal certainties in interpretation was thought to be as reactionary in its implications as was the manufactured consensus of the established political order. Metaphor. The plausibility of this way of seeing texts as forms of deconstructible rhetorical play, however truth-telling in intention, was greatly reinforced by the thesis inherited from Nietzsche and a reading of Plato that right through language, including the most realistic parts of George Eliot, the apparently literal is also really metaphorical. Philosophy and history, neither any longer to be privileged as literal or truth-telling discourses, can be read as if they were literature and vice versa. We no longer believe in the literal as a kind of language referring unambiguously to reality, because all candidates for the literal can be shown to be metaphorical when more closely analyzed. This view of language in general has met with a growing acceptance from many linguists, notably as led, not uncontroversially, by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, who acknowledge the influence of Derrida in seeing the whole of everyday language as organized by metaphor. To that extent, they too are inclined to argue that a philosophically objectivist view of the world is untenable. Such linguistic work has attempted to show that we actually think every day through interlocking conceptual systems based on metaphors, which cannot be reduced in any way to a more literal language, and so are very unlikely to be simply or systematically compatible with one another. It was the political and ethical consequences of this kind of analysis that were of interest to postmodernists in general, for the deconstructors had maintained that all systems of thought, once seen as metaphorical, inevitably led to contradictions or paradoxes or impasses or aporias, to use the Derridian word, which is the rhetorical term for a dubitative question. This is because, for Derridians, the metaphorical characteristics of a language system will always ensure that it actually fails to command or master the subject matter which it purports to explain. These arguments enchanted a very large number of literary critics in the 1970s and early 1980s, and they still do. For deconstruction of this kind was an avant-garde, skeptical, contradiction-revealing strategy, which could undermine, subvert, expose, undo, and transgress any text. What is more, it had exciting political implications, since it showed the indubitable superiority of the deconstructor's insights to the text's unwitting blindness to the contradictions it encoded. To deconstruct a poem, text, or discourse is to show how it actually undermines the philosophy it seems to assert, or the hierarchical oppositions on which it overtly relies. And deconstruction was most effective when the contradictions it thus revealed were of moral or political importance. Here is a rather rough example of a deconstructive approach based on part of a poem by the young Tennyson, who writes of his revered Isabel, the crown and head, the stately flower of female fortitude, of perfect wifehood and pure lowlihead. Stanza 2. The intuitive decision of a bright and thorough-edged intellect to part error from crime, a prudence to withhold, the laws of marriage charactered in gold upon the blanched tablets of her heart, a love still burning upward, giving light to read those laws, an accent very low in blandishment, but a most silver flow of subtle-paced counsel in distress, right to the heart and brain, though undescried, winning its way with extreme gentleness through all the outworks of suspicious pride, a courage to endure and to obey, a hate of gossip parlance and of sway, crowned Isabel, through all her placid life, the queen of marriage, a most perfect wife. This is meant to praise, in fulsomely religiose language, but the topics chosen to reinforce these strategies can be seen to be, within our own historical context, objectionable. And the deconstructor can say that their inadequacy to our sense of reality, or rather to political correctness, will derive from the fact that they are really based on fantasy, that is, on an uneasy relationship between the literal and the metaphorical in the poem. They will reveal within themselves, if we look carefully, an unease about the very distinctions on which they trade. And so the poem will fall apart. For a highly objectionable dominance of men over women is disguised, and made acceptable, to men at least, by the pretense that women can indeed reign over men, but only in morally acceptable ways. They have the virtue, we have the power. But virtue, particularly of the peculiarly self-abnegating kind praised by Tennyson, isn't a power at all. It is allowed to arise only in a metaphorical, rather than a literal, marriage context in which women are powerless. Hence the unfortunate conjunction of perfect wifehood and pure lowlihead. What is more, Isabel can use her intelligence only intuitively when dividing error from crime, reinforcing the old opposition, women are intuitive and men reasonable. And just in case her intuition lets her down, she carries the Moses-like laws of marriage around with her as an aide-mémoire, which is furthermore charactered on the pure, blank, blanched tablets of her heart. Even her heart is white, bloodless, and empty. She is indeed a tabula rasa for male fantasy. Even the love she feels is allowed to do little more than engender light to read those laws. Her only weapons in distress are gentleness and a courage which is significantly tempered by obedience. She doesn't want sway, and yet she is godlike, since there is no harm in a worship that doesn't directly confront sexual differences. Tennyson's poem, paradoxically, and to its own deconstruction, subordinates Isabel while praising her to the skies. In arguing that language can lead us astray in this way, and that reality can never be wholly or convincingly mastered, deconstruction refuses to accept the possibility of any sustained realism in the texts it attacks. This attack on realism is absolutely central to all types of postmodernist activity. But in refusing to come inside any existing system, or to make any exposition of one, in anything but a playful or evasive manner, it also has to deny the possibility of proposing a system of its own without betraying its own premises. Hence the accusation frequently made against deconstructor postmodernists that they are just skeptics who cannot make significant moral or political commitments. Deconstructors too often, true to their own premises, tangle themselves up in a perpetual regress of qualification. Much deconstructive criticism, for example, Jeffrey Hartman's Glass, and much of the work of Paul de Man and Hillis Miller, now seems to be self-indulgent and self-absorbed, and ultimately uncommitted to anything that matters. Those examples of deconstructive interpretation that are most convincing, in fact, arbitrarily arrest this playful regress for the purpose of standing by a thesis that isn't, at least immediately, being criticized. Out-and-out deconstructors can never quite get away from the accusation that their work is at best a form of pragmatic criticism of our beliefs, and is in the end in the same old philosophical business of pointing out not so much that if you contradict yourself, you haven't said anything, which would for them be far too much tied to a literal, traditional, truth-telling logic, as that if you contradict yourself, you open up all sorts of interesting pathways for exploration. After all, according to them, we will all inevitably do this, and the only possible response to that is to make another move in the game, not to be so bold as to rule out some moves as simply illegitimate. Traditional deconstruction is not so much a testable theory, then, as a continuing project.